my name is David Reske, CEO of Now Speed Marketing, and welcome to this edition of In the Now, where we focus on uncovering the myths and misunderstandings of marketing and leadership with some of the world's most interesting people. And my guest today is Mike Mitchell. Mike is a fractional chief marketing officer who does strategic work for a handful of companies that need a strategic marketing role, but don't always want the expense and uncertainty that comes with hiring a full-time CMO. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, David.
Really appreciate you being here. You're working with one company now or multiple companies? What's your current workload look like?
I'm just working with one company right now. I found, in order to really provide any meaningful value, they just require a bit more of my concentration. So kind of jumping back and forth from one to the other sometimes can be challenging for me anyways.
Yeah, that's great. Well, you've had a lot of experience and I'm looking forward to sharing some of that with our audience today. So thanks a lot. As you know, I like to start these conversations with a Mythbuster question. And the issue that you and I were talking about is a question around marketing methods, launching versus growing the company. So the topic that I just wanted to share with you, the potential myth is that the marketing methods and practices that helped you launch the company are the ones you should rely on to grow the business. True or not true?
I would say in most cases, not true. And I say most cases because there are certainly examples of tech companies that seemingly just took off from year one. I mean, there was Slack and Zendesk and OneTrust, and there's many others. But yeah, by and large, the things that got you from point A to point B, and let's maybe just call point B a Series A round, are not necessarily the methods and practices that are going to get you to point C and beyond, right? And I think most founders are aware of that. I think when they look to take in an investment, they're many times looking for more than just the infusion of capital. It's also the infusion of knowledge and bringing in board members that have been there and done it before. I would say also it's really more than just methods and practices. It's about laying a foundation that scales. It's about instituting this operational rigor, but by also staying nimble enough so that you can adapt to changes as they occur. And so I'll expand on that. What I found, and this isn't universal, but in many cases, companies I've worked with, either in a full-time or a fractional capacity, when I say foundation, there are just like simple elementary things that often just don't exist. And I think it's because, you take a product to market, right? And it's just this mad dash to build something that's viable, to acquire customers, and ultimately demonstrate that there's just viability to your startup to begin with, right? And along the way, there are certain operational things and revenue operation things that just kind of go by the wayside because of the pace in which you're moving. But it's important to instill those, I think, before you really scale, because the bigger you get, the harder it is to kind of put the genie back in the lamp, so to speak. And by that, I mean is really determining who are your ideal customers, right? I think what happens sometimes is founder starts an organization, they have a network of people that are their initial group of potential buyers. They purchase the offering, they use the offering, they're happy with it. But then really trying to go direct beyond that is where sometimes they stumble a bit. So I think it's really important then to just understand, like, if I'm going to go direct, who are my real customers? And it's more than just, I have this set group of customers that are in this industry or segment, therefore my ICP is this. I think it takes a bit more analysis to really find really where your sweet spot is. What I always suggest and have done in the past is, all right, well, let's just look at our customer base and uncover traits like, who are our most profitable customers? How long was the sales cycle? What is the average lifetime value? If you're using any type of CSAT or net promoter metric, of the customer mix you have, who are generally the most delighted or happiest customers you have? Which channels or campaigns ultimately were the most successful in creating customers to begin with? So, you know, ideally what you want to try and do is just avoid the whole spray and pray approach. I mean, I realize I'm stating the wildly obvious here, but you want to pursue targets that are the best fit for your offering, that have higher average ACV, that cost the least to acquire, the least to service, and ultimately have shorter sales cycles and the lowest churn rate. I'd say the other thing fundamentally is just is marketing and sales alignment. And again, it's probably stating the obvious here, but in practice, sometimes I've observed situations where it just isn't there. Not adversarial, but there just isn't that alignment that you need or want. I think it's very important from the onset is just to establish roles and responsibilities. Lead definitions. You know, what are we defining as an MQL, as in an SQL? What is the lead quota that we're going to need? You know, working backwards from your revenue target. And you may not always have the benefit of conversion rates. So you have to just establish a baseline and that you'll modify that along the way. Things like lead routing and establishing service level agreements both ways. So what I've always tried to do in the past is if an inbound lead comes in, I want them contacted within 5 minutes. Because the longer you wait, the more likely they are to ghost you. You know, you work pretty hard to try and attract potential buyers to your website and other channels. And the speed at which you can connect and engage with that person means everything. That's why, you know, using technologies like chatbots and things like that allow you to engage with them quickly. But yeah. In the case where somebody fills out a form, the pace at which you can contact that person and engage with them, I mean, the clock is ticking.
So there's a lot of things, Mike, that you've got to do as you evolve that organization. I just want to take you back to that startup phase where you've got that founder, he or she is reaching out to their network, they're kind of growing. What is typically the role of marketing in those days, you know, at the startup phase? What should marketing contribute at that point?
Well, a lot of times there just isn't marketing. But to answer your question, what I found is this, it's just kind of the bare bones, right? We need content, need a website. This is even before even considering a marketing automation system. But, you know, we need compelling content. We need content that really demonstrates the value that our offering provides, you know, with empirical evidence of that. If there are ROI that we can extrapolate and then produce or create, you know, content that builds upon that ROI. There's a concept called the low risk recipe, right? And I think really ultimately what you're trying to do is just that, is limit or remove any trepidation that a potential buyer may have. And the way that you go about doing that is by demonstrating that couple of things, that there is validation of your offering by virtue of their peers in the industry that have used it, any other third party analysis that's been done, ROI, all of those things. So kind of a long-winded way of saying it, David, but I think marketing ultimately, their responsibilities early on are that it's just building good, compelling content that will attract potential buyers, and then just having the means of capturing leads, you know, via website.
Yeah. So I met with a potential client yesterday, and they were a startup and they had a kind of a basic website, and they were asking me, hey, what should I do next? I've got the website, not really happy with it. They may want to design a new website, very thin content, but they also don't have SEO. They don't have any advertising. They're thinking about starting to spend a little bit of money on Google Ads. They're thinking about doing social media. They'd love to do marketing automation. They'd love to do email marketing. What should I have told them that their next step is? Like, you know, it's a one-man show. He's in a B2B tech environment. What's usually the best next step for him to do in that case?
I would think build a database first of your prospects. All right. And there's a number of different ways that you can do that, but I would start there. And that way you can at least start some outbound motion, because SEO takes, you know, a bit of time to kick in. And there's a lot of technical components to that that take some time to kick in. So I would say even before that is just trying to build a database of people that match your ideal customer profile so that you can start proactively prospecting into that list.
And that kind of supports what the founder might be doing with reaching out to his or her network, starting to do direct sales, really got to get those initial orders flowing, right? Like that. And so you kind of move from there, and then you know, you kind of grow and have some early success. What do you observe are the biggest pivots that marketing goes through in the first couple of years at a B2B tech company? Like, because are these all natural evolutions? You kind of go from, you've got, you know, you're setting up initial systems, you're kind of doing it step by step, but are there big pivots that happen that tend to, you know, in your experience, where marketing has to change direction from something that's not working or working and move into a different place?
I think yes. And I think it just comes down to being data driven, which has become cliche, right? But it's important because that tells you when you need to pivot, right? Mm. By establishing baseline KPIs and measuring things so that you can really, you know, really measure the outcomes of programs. So that way you can tell, you know, I'm fortunate to have some great mentors in my career, and the edict was always just fail early. So we waste a lot of cycles. And the way that you do that is just making sure that you not only establish KPIs to help you measure against, but also have a means of collecting that data so that you can make those changes. It goes back to what I was saying also is, you know, you want to institute that operational rigor, but you have to be nimble enough because changes are likely going to occur. Market conditions will occur. Demand can change. But I think the best way to do that is by just understanding, you know, letting the data help you make those decisions of where your best opportunities lie.
Yeah. And you're a big believer in really understanding that ideal customer profile and really getting into the head of the buyer and making sure that's right. What's the best way to do that? You know, whether you're an early stage company or later, how do you really understand what the buyer is all about?
You know, I mean, the simplest and easiest thing to do is just talk to them, right? But it's sometimes, depending on the role in organization, like if sales is talking or a customer success manager is talking to a customer, you know, what they're focusing on is going to be entirely different. So the conversation is oftentimes left, I think better left to marketing, right? So that way we can ask them questions like, you know, tell me about the pain you were experiencing. And I always like to say that there's a moment that occurs when the cost of doing nothing exceeds the cost of doing something, right? So I can continue doing things the way I'm doing, but ultimately that the cost of doing that is going to exceed what it ultimately would cost me into bringing in some type of solution to remedy the challenge I was having. And I think it's just really getting to the heart of that, right? Really, what are the pain points? And really understanding how did our solution help you solve that? And then from there, trying to extrapolate any type of ROI. And I think oftentimes, you know, a customer is not necessarily going to think of hard ROI. It could be anecdotal and soft. So sometimes it's a bit of a challenge just to get them to think in those terms. But I think at the very least, just getting a better understanding of that, and then just understanding the unique characteristics of that company and the relationship that your company has had with them. So going back to the moment that they became a customer and what has transpired since then, you know, where are they at in terms of just the lifetime spend that they've had? Are they generally happy as evident by their CSAT scores or NPS? You know, in the best case, if you have a customer that is delighted in that promoter parlance, then that means that by that very definition, they're willing to refer. And so that's, you know, ultimately what you're, you know, really want to base your ICP analysis on is just you know, focusing on targets that are just going to be the best fit for your offering and quantifying that by average lifetime spend, you know, companies that have bought more or additional offerings from you that, you know, generally cost the least a service and on the acquisition side of things, just cost you the least to acquire with where the sales cycle is the shortest.
Yeah. And so that sounds like a really powerful process that you're going through to do those interviews, those conversations, to really figure out what the buyer really wants and how you can service them most effectively. And you're learning a lot. Maybe, you know, we're kind of talking about this mythical place of like past you know, startup and when you're trying to really grow the company, right? So you come in, you're learning a lot, and you're sharing all this now with the VP of sales, with the CEO, and you know, what's the best way to kind of get alignment there? Because you're learning some things and that may or may not jive with their experience of the people that they're selling. How do you kind of get that alignment? And then, you know, the challenge in marketing is often then we have to publish it, right? Then we have to put it on the website. We've come up with the headline, the message, the campaigns, the programs that really embody that thinking. So you kind of have to lock it in, right? So how do you go through that process as a leader of kind of getting alignment and bringing the whole company together on that?
You know, I think the easiest way to do that is just there should be evidence to support that. Mm-hmm. And just presenting things in a way that it's based on your findings, that you're presenting them in such a way that it's fact-based, and you know, you're leaving very little to like gut, right? These are the things that I've validated, through interviews and, but also the data that supports it. I think also focusing on really what the market opportunity is too, right? So I think really understanding what your serviceable obtainable market is, right? So you think of the TAM, SAM, and SOM, and the serviceable obtainable market is really, this is the pool of potential customers that I feel like based on the analysis I've done, I would have the greatest success in penetrating and attracting those customers. So presenting it in that way, so that way that it's pretty evident really what the market opportunity is. You know, as part of that, I think it's, you don't want to be so narrowly, you know, locked in, right? You also want to pay attention to, I think in every case, there's always going to be this outlier, right? That seemingly is an odd duck, right? But I think it's important to look at those too, because it could be a track into a new segment that maybe you hadn't considered where you've identified that there is a potential product market fit. But back to your original point, I think it's a case of, you know, here's the analysis we conducted. We believe that our best opportunities lie here and for these very reasons. And this is really what the available or the serviceable attainable market looks like. I think when people can see things in that perspective, and then following that up with a plan on how between marketing and sales, we intend to penetrate that. You know, account-based marketing has been kind of the method du jour over the last couple of years. I think this is a perfect time to do that, because to me, ABM is less about, and some people may disagree with me, it's less about the tactics that you employ and more about the alignment of sales and marketing that occurs before you even begin to run campaigns and start prospecting into that pool.
Yeah, and that makes it really powerful. So it feels like what you're saying is you're going to get that alignment on messaging and the target customer. And when sales starts going that direction, you know, with their sales outreach, ABM strategy, marketing support that, you get the message on the website, you get all the marketing materials aligned that, you've got this alignment. What it feels like should happen next is everything should get easier, right? If you're right, right? If you're right, you know, the close rate should get higher, the conversion rate should get higher, the cost per click gets lower. All of those metrics should go in the right direction. And it sounds like what you're saying is you can use data to kind of validate whether or not your theories or your analysis, I should say, is really working. You know, how do you validate that? Is it, am I on the right track with that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think. Well, part of it is just there just needs to be a feedback loop between sales and marketing. And I always make sure that marketing isn't operating in a vacuum. I think when we start thinking of messaging too, that sales very much needs to be a part of that, because they're hearing and seeing things that sometimes marketing cannot or doesn't have the ability to see, because we're not on sales calls all the time or demos or things like that. So I think it's important just to establish that feedback loop. And then from there, just making adjustments. You know, pretty quickly, I'd say within a couple of quarters, if directionally you're on target with regards to prospects, if you've done the homework, then you should be pointed in the right direction. There should be, you know, an available pool from which to prospect into. I think sometimes people get a little uncomfortable when that number decreases. It's, I think you know, having a bigger pond to fish in with thousands and thousands and thousands of opportunities tends to make people a bit more comfortable. But, you know, your better opportunity is going to lie is just narrowing that down so that you have the best opportunity of converting leads and ultimately closing them when you're just really locked in on what the, you know, what the right profile should be.
You know, as a marketer, I think you make a really compelling case that that's the way to build that alignment and that you find it out. But in practice, is it that clear, or is it often more messy than that? Do you kind of go through that analysis, get that, you know, focus on the target market, the messaging, the differentiated, build it out, get the alignment with sales? What are the things that, I guess maybe what I'm asking is, what are the things that can go wrong in that process to kind of mess up that really nice, those really nice steps toward an easier, simpler, more successful marketing and sales function?
It's never really quite as elegant as you hope for it to be. I think there's always just going to be some things that occur along the way. I've been fortunate. I've worked with some really terrific sales leaders in my career. We've gotten along great and have worked really well. And I think the reason for that is we feel a mutual responsibility to ensure the success of sales, right? You would expect that from a sales leader, but oftentimes you may not see that from marketing leaders. And I think it's very important, right? So that way, and again, it just goes back to that feedback loop. We know pretty quickly if messaging isn't on point or isn't working, right? But making sure that there's that open feedback loop. So one of the things I've done throughout my career is I do a weekly huddle with the sales team. I want to hear from them. I think, you know, sales teams, they're always going to want more leads, more leads, more leads, right? Which I totally get, right? But I think understanding where there are performance issues, you know, usually is going to require a concerted effort between a marketing and sales leader, right? And by that, I mean, you know, if you have an SDR team, coaching them and helping them really be proficient at stating what the value proposition is, and helping them undercover or help them become more comfortable with who the competitors are and how to talk against that. So so to answer your question, David, I think it really just comes down to that. You know, are you siloed in your efforts, or are you combined? And I think there's just been this trend over the last couple of years of really what you see is really more of a combined like revenue team that's comprised of sales and marketing and SDRs versus more of this siloed approach. Does that answer your question, David?
Yeah, absolutely. So I love the way you said that, a combined revenue team, where sales and marketing is integrated. And it feels like sometimes personalities or ego or maybe financial incentives or, you know, dysfunctional, emotionally unintelligent people, that can all kind of get in the way of that. But what you're saying is when you don't have that, when you have people who are aligned and really working well together, you can get on the same page. I think the other probably the thing that makes that work is a sense of competence and trust in the other person's ability. So if you've got a head of sales that's really executing well, head of marketing that's executing well, they can come together to be confident in each other's abilities and each other's roles to make sure that you're on the same page. In your experience, is that a big education opportunity with the sales leaders you've worked with, or do they kind of get it and they're like, no, this is exactly what I want you to do marketing? Or do you kind of have to come in there and say, here's all the things that I can do, I'm going to do, I should do, you know, and, you know, how do you get that kind of alignment of roles? Or do they, the people you've worked with in your experience, kind of get it and know what you're going to do off the bat?
I think, you know, from my perspective, it's really just demonstrating a vested interest in the success of their team. Hmm. And I think once you can establish that, then, and where they perceive you as more of a partner, versus just kind of this siloed entity in an organization, then usually things just tend to work out well from there. There's always going to be personalities and egos, and that's, you know, that's not likely to change. I think, you know, the saying goes, right, high tide rises all boats, right? So, but in those instances where things are underperforming, I think really forging that relationship so that you have that partnership internally, so that like, all right, we are mutually going to try and solve this problem rather than just throwing it over the wall. It doesn't always happen right from the instant, and it doesn't always happen just organically. You know, sometimes it just takes a little bit of time and effort to demonstrate, you know, me as a marketer, to demonstrate to sales leaders that I'm committed, you know, to trying to help your team perform as best that they can. And here is how I intend to do that. So that way it's just less about lip service and like, here is my actual plan. They just have to be bought into the plan. Sometimes that's harder than others, but sometimes it's, you know, a little bit more difficult than other things. But I think by just doing that and presenting a plan and demonstrating your willingness to participate in their success just goes a long way.
Yeah, absolutely. We started this conversation talking about that point of pivot, right? So that point where you know, the things that work in the beginning don't always work later, and you have to pivot at some point. And sometimes those pivots feels like could be operational, get add these capabilities. Sometimes it could be messaging. Sometimes it could be maybe product, you know, product pivots as well. So we different market segments we're going after. You know, in your experience, what are the big pivots that you've seen in companies, and how do they navigate those pivots? Because I think the pivot happens almost by definition when something's not working, right? Yeah. We're going after this market. They're not buying at the rate we want. You know, the sales are lower than we thought. The average sales size is too small. Close rate. People aren't, all these problems come up. How do we, you know, what are the pivots that you've seen that have been most successful?
So there's a couple different ways that there's really on the tactical level, like, all right, these tactics that we're using are just not converting, right? And like paid search is a great way to burn through a lot of money with minimal results. What I found that sometimes that have been successful is if you're dealing with an audience that tends to be not as digitally inclined, there's always direct mail. And I know that seems archaic to some, but you'd be surprised if you're catering to an industry that maybe isn't, you know, again, is digitally inclined, maybe don't check email or not really likely to the manner in which they're going to investigate or look for a potential solution may not occur in the sense that we think of today digitally, right? Sometimes it's offline. And in those cases, sometimes direct mail is a pretty good tactic. I think in other cases too, it's just revisiting the content that you have and making sure that you're very clearly articulating what the value is. I would say just from a product perspective, you know, what I've seen work is this, where a company has a initial offering, let's call it, and the barrier of entry is not necessarily steep from a cost standpoint, but just getting access and using and starting to see the value, there's just friction involved. So trying to break off aspects of that offering so that you have basically a freemium version of that. I've seen, you know, that's worked successfully for many, many organizations. You know, think of like a product-led growth model, and there's countless examples out there. So what you're doing is at least providing, you know, something, a means of experiencing some of the value that a solution can provide, and then with a clear path to upsell and cross-sell. I think it's just becoming more the norm now, where, you know, people are impatient, me included. I just want to try something out. I want to see what it looks like. I want to experience what it looks like. And then, you know, from there, if I want to talk to sales and learn more about it, but I think it's just, you know, that, and I think that just, that's consumer behavior in general. Now we just want to see and experience things on our own first before we decide to talk to a sales rep. So in answering your question, David, I think companies that have figured out a way to break off certain parts of their offering and position them as more of a freemium version, getting people's foot in the door. And then from there, it usually there's a little bit less friction involved in converting them to a paid customer. I've seen that work in a lot of examples.
Yeah, I think what you're describing is some pivots that are operational and tactical, and maybe those are the pivots we like the best. If the product is not selling, we've got no revenue, then we may have to make a big pivot, right? But what you're describing is a case where you've got a successful company, things are working, but we want to make them work better. And so we want to pivot. We might have the freemium product. We might try tactics like direct mail, fixed page search, add new content, get honed in on the target customer's buying needs. All of those tactics are, it feels like, you know, problem solving at every level that you're able to do at that, you know, to, in order to pivot into a place of success. Am I describing that well?
I think so. You know, from a pure product pivot perspective, so I'm in the Atlanta area, and I think one of the most successful pivots that I've observed, certainly in Atlanta, if not, you know, nationally, is a company called SalesLoft, right? SalesLoft started out actually as this prospecting tool. It was essentially like a bolt-on for LinkedIn, right? So, you know, what that enables you to do is this. I mean, there's plenty of tools out there, right? I have a prospect profile in mind, and I just want to basically be able to scrape LinkedIn and try to, you know, capture as many prospects and targets as I can. And then LinkedIn just kind of cut the cord and made it difficult for SalesLoft and others like them to do that. So instead, what they did is they pivoted. They had this cadence tool. And in a sense, really created a category, right? So what they did is pivoted to that. So the cadence tool is something that's used by sales, and if you're not familiar, and SDRs, it just kind of maps out a cadence for them so that, you know, everything is just kind of pre-built, right? I've got my set list of prospects. Here are my email templates. I'm going to send them this email on this day. I'm going to call them on this day. Maybe I'll send them a LinkedIn connection on this day. And they've been wildly successful. You know, so from a pure product perspective, I mean, just talk about making lemonade, all right? You have one aspect of your business that was seemingly rather successful, and understanding that the path forward is really converting over and doing something that, as I understand it, they created the cadence tool internally for their own teams and have been wildly successful since. So that, to me, I find that inspiring, right? They're just a bunch of smart people over there, but the fact that they were able to adapt so quickly and realize some success, to me, is extraordinary.
Yeah, that's a great example. And probably used a lot of the principles that you've been talking about. They probably had a deep understanding of their target customer and the needs that they had. And then they looked at the available technology and what they could provide. And basically they're meeting the needs of that target buyer, but in a different way as the product opportunity changes. So very cool. Well, this has been a great conversation, Mike. I really appreciate your thoughts. I think this idea of evolving marketing as the company's growing and pivoting, whether it's a product pivot or a marketing message pivot or into a new market, all of those things are challenging things. And clearly you're an expert at this. You've had a lot of great experience and you made a lot of impact on many companies. So thanks for sharing your experience. And people want to get in touch with you to learn more about your services or how to work with you. How would they do that? What's the best way to contact you?
You can find me on LinkedIn. My LinkedIn, I can share my LinkedIn page. It's actually pretty simple. It's LinkedIn. You can find me, trying to remember how my, it's Michael C. Mitchell Atlanta.
Perfect.
Is what my profile's under. So you can reach me that way. And I always love meeting new marketers, and I'm a marketing nerd at heart. So if you get two marketers in a room or online, you know, we can talk for hours and hours. So I'd love to continue the conversation with anybody or ask there any questions or provide any helpful recommendations. So just reach out to me. Let me know.
That's great. Well, thanks, Mike, for taking the time. I really appreciate the conversation today.
Thank you, David.